Well, thank you, Brad, for that kind introduction. I'd also like to thank CEDA for the invitation to speak here today. Let me also express my gratitude by saying that we continue to learn a lot about the mining industry, and we do so in many ways, but including through our liaison contacts in WA. And I'm guessing that includes quite a number of people in the audience here today, so thank you for that. I thought this would be a good chance to reflect on two key developments that stand out in my mind over the past year. The first is what's been happening in China, and then the second, which is closely related, of course, is the change to the outlook in mining investment in Australia. And both obviously have an important bearing on the economy here in WA. So China's economic development has been really truly remarkable by any measure. It's been three decades now that it has sustained growth at an average of around 10% per annum. China now accounts for a substantial and increasing share of the global economic activity. Indeed, over the past 10 years, it's tripled its share of the global economy. It's now the second largest economy after the US. China uses a large share of the total global output of commodities, not only because it is big, but because it makes relatively intensive use of raw commodities. So this reflects the high rate of investment in China as it adds rapidly to its stocks of both capital and its stocks of housing. One driver of this has been the rapid urbanisation of China. This requires the construction of new housing, places of work, as well as transport, communications, power, and water storage and treatment facilities. China now uses about half of the world's production of iron ore, coking coal, and thermal coal. Not surprisingly, then, the growth of China has seen the prices of Australia's commodity exports rise to unprecedented levels. As you can see here, Australia's terms of trade, which, as Michael said, really is the price of our exports relative to the price of our imports. Well, Australia's terms of trade started rising rapidly from around the mid-2000 to reach an historic peak in late 2011. So this has led, obviously, to a dramatic increase in investment in the resource sector in Australia, much of that evident here. Even though the terms of trade have declined since this peak, they still remain well above their averages of a decade ago. So the decline in Australia's terms of trade since late 2011, that coincided with the slowing in the pace of China's economic growth and, as Michael suggested, a degree of concern at the time about its near-term outlook. So not surprisingly, for much of the past year, we and others have been looking for signs that China's growth might stabilise. A broad range of indicators now suggest that this has occurred, with economic conditions improving through the second half of last year. And the national accounts data, they indicate that growth is running at around 8% in year-ended terms. Still, as you can see here, the path of growth in China has not been a smooth one, and China will no doubt continue to experience cyclical variation in economic conditions that will need to be carefully managed. Such cycles will, of course, have important implications for the prices of commodities because of the size and the makeup of China's economy. So, and then changes in commodity prices will then in turn influence the outlook for the resource sector here in Australia. I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes, but for now let me just turn to this question that's on my mind of what is the rate of growth in China that they might be able to sustain in the years ahead. A gradual slowdown in the trend growth rate of China's economy is to be expected as the process of development there runs its course. Exactly what the trend growth will look like, though, that's very hard to know. One way to think about that is to break China's productive capacity into its key elements. You've got its supply of labour, its stock of capital, and then how productively it can combine these things to produce goods and services. I think the growth rate of the labour force is perhaps the easiest of these to get a handle on. It's easier to forecast because it's driven by fairly slow-moving and relatively predictable demographic forces. So the working-age population for the country as a whole is expected to peak sometime around the middle of this decade. and absent a significant increase in the rate of labour force participation, this of course implies less growth in the overall labour force. However, perhaps the much more important question is what will happen to the growth of the urban workforce? And this is critical because it's this urbanisation process is the means by which the relatively unproductive labour in the rural sector finds its way into more productive activities in urban centres where much of the capital resides. So as you can see here, and this is a graph that I've took from a piece of work we published last year, and so therefore the projections are from that paper, but they line up with other projections that we see. It seems that urbanisation in China still has a way to go, and that's particularly true of the central and western regions of China. Nevertheless, as I think you can discern from the slope of this projections, the pace of urbanisation is likely to slow over time. Now, growth in the capital stock is also likely to slow. That's in part because there's already been a substantial rise in the capital stock as a share of labour, but it's also because households are likely to want to consume an increasing share of the country's rising incomes. Even so, the capital stock per worker is only a small fraction of where the US level is, so there's clearly scope for continued rapid growth in China's capital stock. But perhaps the greatest source of uncertainty is the speed with which the level of productivity in China can approach that of the advanced economies. History suggests that as a country draws just a little closer to the productivity frontier, it often becomes much more difficult to sustain the same pace of productivity growth that's come before. It tends to get just that little bit harder to pursue reforms that help to drive productivity growth. And those reforms that yield the best returns and tend to be the easiest to pursue, well, those are the ones that have already been done. The low-hanging fruit has already been picked off that tree. In a similar vein, it's easier to emulate and even improve upon a range of the production processes that have long been in use somewhere else in the world. But it's much harder to adopt the newer, more advanced technologies, the efficient ways of organising production processes across lots of activities, including the provision of services. Anyway, by any reasonable estimate, China still remains a long way from the productive frontier, so there's considerable scope for it to continue to catch up with the advanced economies. Now, there's a range of estimates out there for potential output growth that have been constructed on the basis of making predictions of these three key elements of the production process. The OECD, I'll just point to that one for now, they predict that potential output growth for China will decline from somewhere around 10% that we've seen in the 2000s to 9.5% in the current year, thereabouts, and then gradually declining to 5% by the middle of the next decade. Last year, the Chinese authorities themselves, they lowered their official growth target from 8 to 7.5%. Though, of course, the economy, as we could, if you can recall the earlier chart, had for years consistently overshot even that higher target. But that's all very well, but another way we can try to gauge the potential output of an economy, and it's one that I particularly like as a central banker, is to look at this relationship between growth and inflation. So what's the idea here? The idea is that high and rising inflationary pressures, those tend to follow a period when demand is also growing faster than potential output and vice versa. Now, if you peer long enough, I think you can see in this graph that over recent years, inflationary pressures have tended to ease in China whenever the growth had slowed substantially towards 8% or lower. You can see that during the GFC period and more recently. And conversely, around 2010, we saw inflationary pressures building when growth was turning up to around 10% or higher. And that was a growth rate, by the way, that did not appear to cause undue inflationary pressures in the early 2000s. So taking all of this and noting the behaviour of inflation more recently suggests to me at least that potential output growth in China might be somewhere around the current rate of GDP growth, which is 8%. So what does all this mean for commodities? The prospects for Chinese demand for commodities, that will depend not just on the growth rate of the economy there, but also on the composition of that growth. As growth in China and elsewhere in the world was slowing through 2012, growth in the demand for steel slowed, and that led to very sharp declines in the spot prices of iron ore and coking coal from July through to early September. But through 2012, the more accommodative stance of financial policies and the increased public spending that Michael mentioned in China have helped to support a substantial increase in the growth rate of investment in infrastructure. You can see that in the middle panel there, and dwellings in the right-hand panel. And that's helped to stabilise growth in the economy overall. And in line with the stronger outlook for infrastructure investment and residential construction, not surprisingly, the demand for steel has picked up again. The price of steel in China has increased by around 20% since its low point in September last year. Spot price for coking coal has also picked up a little over recent months. But you can see here the spot price for iron ore, the recent movement higher in the red line there, that's an increase which is about four times as high as the increase in steel prices. In part, this appears to reflect the efforts of Chinese steel mills to rebuild their inventories, and most observers don't expect iron ore prices to be sustained at these current levels, as the pink lines suggest. Anyway, residential construction, that's been a key source of demand for steel in the Chinese economy. It currently accounts for as much as 15% of total steel use. And by our own estimates, the quantity of steel used in residential construction has roughly doubled over the past 8 years. This has been driven by urbanisation, as I've already suggested, and rising incomes. And what rising incomes do, in turn, is drive the demand for newer, larger, i.e. taller and higher quality buildings. While we would not expect growth to continue at its recent high rates, steel use from this sector is not expected to peak for some time. Of course, we shouldn't overlook other sources of demand for steel. An obvious one, which Michael mentioned, is the expansion in rail networks, and the demand for steel for this purpose looks likely to continue to grow strongly, with much work yet to be done, develop rail links both between and within cities across China. Indeed, the Ministry of Railways there has increased spending this year and will maintain that at a high level into next year and the year beyond. It's but one of the examples for the still considerable scope for China to add to its infrastructure, and that underpins a range of forecasts for Chinese steel production to continue to grow for another decade and a half. So, in short, just to draw some threads together there, with a lower rate of trend economic growth overall, Chinese demand for commodities will grow somewhat less rapidly than it has in the past. But the expectation is that it will still grow strongly for quite some time. And because the Chinese economy is so much larger now, even a somewhat slower rate of growth represents a very large quantity of new demand for raw materials. So in order to help understand that point, it's worth thinking about steel production. Steel production increased by about 9% in 2011. What did that mean? That meant an extra 58 megatons of steel output. 58 megatons of steel output, additional demand. In 2004, the much higher growth rate of 23%, but on a smaller economy, was equivalent to only 50 megatons. So this is the point I'm trying to get across. Slower growth can still mean a lot of extra quantity of demand for commodities coming down the line. The outlook for mining investment in Australia, let me turn to that now. So despite the potential for further growth in the demand for commodities from China and other developing economies, we expect commodity prices will gradually decline over the next few years. Why is this? Well, it really reflects the extra supply that's coming online, and it's been generated by the substantial amount of mining investment underway in Australia and elsewhere around the world. Nevertheless, commodity prices are expected to remain at what are very historically high levels for a considerable period. The very high price for bulk commodities, that's helped drive mining investment in Australia to around 8% of GDP currently. That's some four times larger than its long-run average, 8%. This has led to a significant increase in the share of economic activity accounted for by the resource sector. So while the share of the workforce directly employed in the business of mining has doubled over this period, it remains relatively modest. It's around 2.5% of the workforce for the economy as a whole. However, there has been a substantial spillover of activity to other parts of the economy, including to a wide range of businesses that help mining companies to extract the resources from the ground or to build up the capital infrastructure for the mining companies. So the bank's about to publish some research providing estimates of the contribution of mining and then these mining-related activities to GDP and employment. And what this work suggests is that the resource sector as a whole, so that's the resource extraction as well as the resource-related activity, as a whole, that accounts for around 18% of GDP. About a third of that is owing to these resource-related activities, the support role. Similarly, the resource sector accounts for almost 10% of employment across the country if we think about this resource, direct resource extraction as well as the resource-related activity. And a bit more of that more than two-thirds of that 10% is owing to resource-related activities. Now, the sharp fall in bulk commodity prices that you can see here in iron ore that occurred from the middle of last year prompted mining firms across the country to reassess their expenditure and the viability of some investment projects that had been under consideration. So some uncommitted projects, they were deferred. Much exploration activity was curtailed. Spending on machinery and equipment was scaled back. And some existing operations were even shut down, primarily the smaller, older, higher-cost coal mines. So this turnaround in sentiment came about in part because lower prices reduced cash flows and external financing became that much harder to come by, making it more difficult to finance resource investment. The recent sharp rise in iron ore prices over recent months, though, as best we can tell, hasn't yet made a difference to the investment plans of companies, presumably because the price is not expected to stay at its current high level. But as Michael has made very clear with his chart, a very large share of mining investment currently underway in Australia is in the liquefied natural gas sector. So LNG projects require significant investment over about a 3 to 5 year period and a very long period of production to then recoup that initial investment. And as a result, commitments to invest in these projects, they're made on the basis of long-term contracts signed with LNG, with the buyers of LNG. And so it is for this reason that investment in LNG has been largely resilient to the significant changes in sentiment affecting these other parts of the resource sector. Of much greater concern for LNG projects are rising costs. Rising costs, of course, reduce the return on projects that are currently underway, and they reduce the prospects of future expansions. Some of what's been reported as higher costs by mining companies reflects the appreciation of the Australian dollar. So some companies had budgeted in earlier times for projects in US dollar terms at a lower exchange rate than we currently face. Still, I think there's no denying that costs have increased over time, even in Australian dollar terms. We can try to look at some of the data from the ABS to gain an understanding of changes in costs over time, although, of course, it's not possible to pick up the important differences across different projects and across different projects in different industries. There is evidence, though, in the aggregate data of higher inflation in wages in the mining industry, that's shown here in red, and across Western Australia more generally, just beyond mining. And while the growth of these wages has picked up a little recently, this is unlikely to be sufficient to account for the magnitude of some of the cost overruns that are being reported. Nevertheless, if we look at the level of wages in the mining industry, they remain relatively high, though this reflects the relatively high capital-to-labour ratio in this industry. One plausible explanation, at least in my mind, for at least some of the cost overruns that we've seen is logistical problems, which have been affecting a number of projects. It seems that the engineering challenges for some projects are even more complex than was initially thought. And there are cases of projects taking longer to complete or requiring more investment to bring them to fruition. And in other cases, the scope of the project may have changed. So all of these things can change that profile for mining investment, affecting both the timing and the amount of expenditure that we can expect. So what's been the net effect of, on the outlook for mining investment, of all of these things? The changes in sentiment, changes in the timing, changes in the scope, changes in the costs. As best we can tell, mining investment now appears likely to reach a peak a little bit earlier, sometime this year, and at a lower level, around 8% of GDP, than we had earlier expected. So this just compares where we are with our latest outlook published in February and where we were back in August of last year. This is broadly consistent with the ABS survey of firms' capital expenditure plans. And that, what that survey shows is that in the mining sector, the growth of nominal investment in the current financial year has been marked down. It was revised down from growth of around 40% in this current financial year to growth of 20% from the June quarter survey, when we move from the June quarter survey to the September quarter surveys. That's how much the growth has been marked down. Anyway, like all forecasts, we should remember that the profile for mining investment is subject to considerable uncertainties. We can't be sure about when the peak's going to occur, nor can we be sure about the pace at which mining investment's going to decline as a share of GDP. This is going to depend not just on the outcome of decisions regarding uncommitted projects, but also on the rate of progress on existing projects and the extent and nature of any of these cost overruns I've been talking about, any further cost overruns that may come to pass. Anyway, notwithstanding this uncertainty, there is still a large amount of work in the pipeline, and so mining investment's likely to remain quite elevated for a time. And as mining investment tails away, we're increasingly going to move, as Michael suggested, into this operational phase of the mining boom. So that's when exports, which is the whole point of the investment in the first place, exports will increase significantly in response to all of the investment that's been undertaken. Strong growth of iron ore, of coal, and of LNG exports, that's been evident now for some time, as you can see here. But further strong growth is anticipated, and particularly for LNG. It's quite striking, some of the charts I've seen produced by a number of entities looking closely at this. So growth of LNG exports is expected to grow much more rapidly from here on in. Well, really actually not starting till around 2015, but then it really takes off. So the revised outlook for mining investment and our predictions for bulk commodity exports, all of those things have been incorporated in our latest forecasts that we published last week in the Statement of Monetary Policy. Our expectation, as you saw in Michael's earlier graph, is that growth of economic activity will be a little below trend over the current year before picking up a little in 2014. And these forecasts assume that growth from sources outside of the resource sector, that picks up gradually. And so we'll be looking very closely for signs of this over the months ahead. And looking further ahead, and as I've suggested in my remarks about China's economy, and I think as Michael outlaid very clearly, Australia is well placed to benefit from the ongoing developments there, as well as in other developing economies in the region. So thank you very much. I'll hand you back to Brad.
Liz Ritchie from CEDA. So I guess the question that springs to mind, each of you have spoken about the confidence and sentiment issues that are being expressed around the country and within business. What do we need to do to turn that sentiment around?
What springs to mind really is some of the commentary you hear from people like Martin Parkinson in Canberra, the Treasury Secretary. He's been heard to complain that people in Australia are behaving as if they live in Greece rather than here at the moment. So it tells you, I suppose, there is this kind of deep-seated concern, and it's not necessarily just domestic issues, but it is also what's happening in the rest of the world. I try to point out a few sort of possible circuit breakers that might actually see this sentiment turn around. And if we do get an environment where perhaps commodity prices start to pick up, or at the very least stop falling from here, that's one potential trigger. If we do see a bit of an improvement in household finances or household balance sheets as house prices stabilise and perhaps pick up a little bit, that's certainly something that will help. Domestically, at least, I really just come back to the labour market. I mean, there has been this unrelenting flow of news, negative news about the labour market, and of course, most people, when they read the newspapers, they look at what's happening on the television. That's their sole source of economic news, and if all you hear is the negatives, then not surprisingly, the people worry about their job prospects. So what we really need to see, I suppose, is just the hard numbers. So if unemployment doesn't go up too much further, if realisation sinks in that, my job probably still will be there in a year's time, then I think some of that sentiment story will start to turn around. Equally, though, as I say, we're hostage to the rest of the world. Any bad news that could pop up there at any moment, clearly beyond our control, but obviously something that, given the experience of the last few years, would weigh back onto the sentiment again.
Maybe I could just add briefly, I don't think I can add much to what Michael said, but just to say, I mean, if you look at the surveys, the fairly comprehensive surveys of consumers done by both the Melbourne Institute and Roy Morgan, they've been showing quite a positive trend since around the middle of last year. Consumers in the most recent reading are feeling better than average across a number of the indicators that go into these surveys. And then the other thing, I guess, is at least at the margin, interest rates are relatively low. So I think that's helping, and it's helping in a number of obvious ways. One thing it's doing is it's helping in the housing market, and we're also seeing asset prices both in the housing market and elsewhere in equity markets sort of turning higher as well. House prices elsewhere in the globe are also picking up, and as are other asset prices, and that's being helped in part by stimulatory monetary policy.
Alison Preston, Curtin University. In the next few months, there'll be a federal but also a state review of the minimum wage. I'm hearing a fairly positive view on the economy and on the labour market. I know there's a bit tempered there, but what might either of your recommendations be to a wage-fixing panel on what might happen to the minimum wage?
I don't know that I could have much to offer there. I think the thing is that, inflation remains pretty well contained. And in that environment, that's something we'd like to see maintained. We'd like to see inflation stay in the target. And one of the things that means is that wage growth, really should follow from productivity. And so productivity is something we all need to focus quite a bit of attention on. And you can get more wage growth without it jeopardising inflation if there's the productivity there to back it up. So I don't think I can say much more than that.